Well, Easter is this Sunday, and of course, we always talk about the Shroud of Turin when we get close to Easter, and we're going to do that with Dr. John DeSalvo. Also, several of his works, The Lost Art of Enochian Magic and Decoding the Enochian Secrets. We'll talk a little bit about that as well. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, here we go. Dr. John DeSalvo, director of the Great Pyramid of Giza Research Association, also the executive vice president for the Association of Scientists and Scholars International for the Shroud of Turin. For more than 30 years, he's been involved in studying the Shroud of Turin. He has taught biochemistry, anatomy, physiology, general biology, and neurophysiology as well. Here he is back on Coast to Coast, one of our favorites, Dr. John DeSalvo. John, how are you?
Hey, great, George. Thanks for having me back, and happy
my pleasure.
Easter to you.
Looking forward to this. Easter here already. This year's going by way too fast, John.
Oh, I know. I tell you. And it seems like the winter's never ending either.
How did you get interested in the Shroud of Turin, and especially for so long?
Yeah, well, you know, I think it was back around 1979. I was visiting my wife's parents in New York, and one of her cousins showed up and had a pamphlet of the Shroud. I've never even heard of the Shroud before, and he was so excited about it, and he showed me this pamphlet with these photos. And, you know, being a scientist, I looked at those pictures and thought, oh, my God, that's not something an artist would produce. It almost looked photographic, and it just got my interest up. So right away, I, started reading through the pamphlet, and it was really funny. My mother-in-law comes over and says, oh, the person who's the world expert and arranged for scientific testing of the Shroud has a church in the next town. He's from Italy, but he has a parish in both places. It's Father Peter Rinaldi, and I'm a good friend of his. So I thought, oh, my God. So to make a long story short, I said, I got to meet this guy before I go back to college. So that's the initial exposure I had. And I called Father Rinaldi, and he invited me over. And we had an incredible meeting. And I left there with the original photographs of the Shroud slides. And he asked me to contact the head of the current research team at that time and get involved in the research and give talks on it. So my life changed with that one meeting 30 years ago. I haven't seen my wife's cousin since. I think his name was Paul Messina, but I wonder if he realized how much it changed my life.
Dramatically, indeed. Well, it's been a fascinating subject for so long. And do you think, John, that we will really get to the bottom of it ever?
I really don't know. You know, as a scientist, I always look at science first and say, you know, if we, and I've said this many times on Coast to Coast before, that something that looks supernatural is just something we haven't discovered yet, or a higher law of science. But we may be dealing with something that's so far above this, which, you know, people call a miracle or something supernatural from God. If it gets to that category, we may never know. If it was produced by some natural method or some physical method that we just haven't discovered, the answer would be yes. My guess, if you know, my pure speculation is I doubt it, because we're talking about this object, this piece of cloth that has undergone more scientific testing and research than any artifact in the world. And to be honest with you, I don't think we're any closer to figuring out how the image was formed. It's almost like the pyramid. There's hundreds and thousands of theories, but little data that can, you know, show why the pyramid was built and by who. And the same with the Shroud. There's a lot of theories on how the image was formed, but we honestly just don't know.
Could we duplicate the Shroud today if we wanted to replicate it?
No. And I know a lot of people, I've gotten tons of emails, and when I give talks, people say, well, all these people that tried to paint it or use different reliefs or medieval photography, a mock crucifixion, I can go on and on. The bottom line is you take any of these objects that were painted or reproduced and you put it next to the Shroud, there's no comparison. It may reproduce some of the characteristics of the Shroud, but not all of them. So that's the biggest problem. There's not one thing that has been produced that even looks close to the Shroud in its quality and majesty. And yet, nothing that will reproduce all the different features which we'll be talking about. So, you know, they may copy one aspect of it or another, but not all of them. So I'm not the only one that feels this way. Most of the researchers that I work with feel the same way. If somebody had the exact duplication of the shroud, I mean, it would be, you know, national news, and everyone would say, oh, okay, now maybe we can figure out the mechanism. So that's kind of what I feel. There's nothing been close to it yet.
John, for a portion of this discussion, let us conclude that the shroud is real. And I want to ask you if you could take us through the crucifixion of Jesus and tell us what happened, how they wrapped him, and what you think might have occurred.
Sure. If people have access to a website, too, they want to go to the Coast site or my site, GizaPyramid.com, and there's photographs and illustrations. But, I'll try to explain. I think most people are familiar. But, you know, after Jesus was crucified and taken down from the cross, he was wrapped in a linen shroud. And the way the images on the Shroud of Turin are produced would be as if the body was laid on half of the cloth with the head in the center, and then the rest of the cloth is folded over to cover the rest of the body up. So when you open the cloth, you would have an imprint of the man in the shroud, which would be head-to-head, the front
image. So if he's 6 feet tall, the shroud is about 12, 13 feet long.
The shroud is actually about 14 and a half feet long by 3.5 feet wide. Now, we don't have a full frontal imprint on it, so it wasn't wrapped exactly in the center, but you're correct. So that's roughly the dimensions.
All right, so they put the body in this shroud, and they loop it over, and then what do they do with it?
And then the shroud was placed in the tomb. Now, some people have argued, somehow the image of the man in the shroud was transferred to the cloth, and, you know, we'll talk about that possibility later.
Sure.
So many people have argued about the Gospels. Maybe it's take a second to talk about that quickly. But in Mark's Gospel and John's, it said that Jesus was wrapped in a linen shroud. The Greek word is syndon, which is just singular. In John's Gospel, he uses the Greek word orthonia, which is plural for linen cloths, meaning more than one. And there's been a little confusion about that. And all it is saying is there may have been more than one cloth involved. And we think there were several, that there was maybe a face veil placed over the man in the shroud, which another gospel refers to as a sudarian. There may have been a jaw band that wrapped around his jaw to keep it closed so it didn't open during rigor mortis. And then maybe the entire shroud was wrapped with, like, bandages to keep it all together. So there's no inconsistency. In fact, the Jews never buried people Egyptian style with bandages. So the idea of a long winding cloth or linen cloth is consistent with the Gospels. But I wanted to bring that up because that's sometimes a source of confusion. Now, the question is, looking at the shroud, can we go back like a forensic pathologist and say what this man was subject to? And just looking at it in general, yes, it definitely looks as a person was crucified. And if you want to start in the head region, you notice in the face there are blood stains or puncture wounds that seem to puncture all parts of the head. If you look at the front and the back, the puncture wounds go through the entire back of the head all the way up to the vertex. So what this really means is that if this person was crowned with thorns, that is, these puncture wounds where these blood stains are, were produced by a crown of thorns. It wasn't in the shape of a wreath or ringlet, but like a cap, like a shower cap, because it punctured all parts of the head up towards the vertex. Again, that would be consistent historically with if a person would have been crowned with thorns. You can see bruises on his face. His nose appears to be swollen, a lot of different things, you know, forensic pathologists can determine. Some of the more notable features would be, if you look at the back, I find this very fascinating, that there are like little, you could say like dumbbell-shaped marks covering the entire back.
Like he was whipped.
Exactly. Yeah. And this is a typical type of scourging instrument known as a Roman flagrum. In fact, we found these in archaeological finds. And they were basically consisted of a handle, like a wooden handle, with two or three leather straps. And at the end of each of these straps, usually would be like little lead balls in the shape of like dumbbells. So the person, this would rip into the person's skin, and then when it came out, would leave a deep and excruciating bruise.
It would just tear their flesh too, wouldn't it?
Exactly. And it's like over 100 of these dumbbell-shaped marks covering the entire back of the body. So this person was scourged significantly. In fact, some people have been able to calculate the angle at which the scourging radiated from and can deduce that two people scourged this person. One stood on the right and one on the left. And I think, if I recall correctly, the person on the right was a little bit taller than the person on the left. So incredible anatomical detail. Again, when you start thinking about painting hypotheses and different things, you know, for a forger to have come up with this would be just incredible. If you also look at the back where the person is scourged, you notice that there are like a quadrangular bruise marks over the shoulder. And medical experts estimate that these bruise marks over the shoulder would correspond to some heavy object placed on it after the scourging. And we know historically that victims of crucifixion did not carry the entire cross. It would have weighed over 300 pounds and just too heavy to carry. But right. They would have carried just a cross beam or crossbar, which probably would weigh maybe about 80 pounds. And that would be consistent with the wound we see on the dorsal of the shoulder area of this person, that he was first scourged and then a cross beam weighing about 60 pounds or so would have been placed over it. So again, extremely, you know, anatomical detail.
The image is of almost like a reverse negative. It's like a negative, isn't it?
Exactly. Well, yeah, in fact, when people ask me, why did I get so interested in the shroud? I say, it seems like only in the last 100 years has man developed the technology necessary to unlock its secrets. And that was in 1898. The first photographs of the shroud were taken. Photography was a fairly new art. And the Vatican commissioned a lawyer, an amateur photographer called Secondo Pia, to take photographs of the shroud. And up to this point, all people knew about the shroud was it had this very faint sepia-colored imprint of a man. It didn't look very lifelike. So Secondo Pia takes his picture and brings it back on May 28th, brings it back to his dark room and develops this large glass negative plate. And he says he felt he was seeing a miracle because instead of this faint, imperceptible image of a face, there was like a three-dimensional, beautiful representation of a human being. And he said he felt he was the first person in 1900 years to see what the man in the shroud actually looked like. And basically what it was is it was a positive imprint on his negative plate, meaning the lights and shadows were in the correct relationship, and which meant if you have a positive imprint on a negative plate, then the shroud itself was similar to a photographic negative. So that was, to me, one of the most important events or discoveries in the history of the shroud, because now we're saying, wow, this is something that existed like a photographic negative hundreds of years before the invention of photography.
Do you think, John, that the body merely evaporated, or did it just give off this burst of energy that, well, you know, and it had just had that image on the shroud?
Well, that is the different theories. There are many theories, some that talk about purely chemical processes that may have produced the image. In fact, one of my first theories was involved in that. There are other theories that speculate the miraculous. And, you know, we could go through those. And also, I have actually recently come up with a new theory, which may have a combination of both those factors. But that's one of the most difficult things about the shroud and how the image was produced. If you look at a process where you say the body came in direct contact with the cloth and transferred chemicals or perspiration or whatever directly to the cloth, mm-hmm. you wouldn't produce the resolution that you would see. For example, if you put ink all over your face and put a cloth up to it and pressed it and opened it up, it would be distorted. So a direct contact process doesn't explain what we see. Then if we look at a process which looks like a vertical projection, it would be like a laser, a direct projection of the body straight onto the cloth, you also wouldn't get the image. You wouldn't actually have enough information. So either process would not work. Together they may, but it has to be filtered in a certain way. And that's one of the problems. If you calculate the way the image was produced using all these different possibilities, you really don't come up with something. Again, there's some that are better than others that we'll talk about, but that's one of the great mysteries. It just doesn't seem to fit together. The other interesting thing, the anatomical aspect you mentioned is that if you want to look at the frontal imprint of the man in the shroud. And by the way, historically, we can document the location of the shroud from 1357 to the present. So for sure. So if the shroud was a forgery, it would have had to been made prior to 1357, even though there's historical evidence, very good historical evidence, to take it back to the 12th century, which we can mention. But if you look at the frontal imprint of the man in the shroud, you notice on the arms and the wrist, there are blood stains that are trickled down and covering the wrist and forearms. Now, the puncture wound is in the wrist, not the palm of the hands. And that's interesting because studies show that if a person or using a cadaver is nailed to the palm of the hand, it wouldn't provide sufficient support to hold the body to the cross. The hands would rip through the nail. Only if the nail was placed in the wrist, in the carpal area, would it provide sufficient support. And there's evidence, too, in archaeological finds and historical records that Romans did nail through the wrist. It would be the most efficient and easiest way to do that. So that's why that's another interesting anatomical piece. Now, some have argued it could even go through the palm of the hand and emerge at the back of the wrist. So there are a lot of variations of this, but I think most anatomists and medical forensic pathologists feel it probably was a crucifixion through the wrist. And
can we rule out Leonardo da Vinci, who was born during that time period that at least has been dated back to?
Yes, and I'll tell you why. Da Vinci's theory, it was very interesting. I mean, I got to say, there's a lot of creative possibilities, but the what was proposed, that Leonardo da Vinci did an early example of photography using a magic lantern, a projector, and some kind of light-sensitive chemical that he would, it was a very complicated process to do. I don't even know if you could repeat it. But so he basically, it was like a camera obscura, and he produced the image on photographic chemicals. And a couple major problems with this first was, one is Leonardo da Vinci was born in 1452. We knew the shroud existed at least 100 years prior to that. And like I'm telling you, there's even extremely good evidence that historical evidence that existed since the 12th century. Right. The other thing is the image produced this way, people have tried, will not produce three-dimensional information on the cloth. And I got to explain what that is in a second. But the other interesting aspect is spectroscopic studies of the shroud does not show that there's any kind of chemical substance or photographic emulsion that would be proposed the way Leonardo da Vinci would have done it. And one of the biggest pieces of evidence is the blood went on the cloth first, George, and then later the image was produced because there's no image area under the blood. So Leonardo da Vinci or a painter would have had to put all these blood stains on the cloth and then produce the image or paint the image, which would be physically impossible.
Is the blood too old, John, to get a blood type and maybe even use it to clone?
The tests that have been done to me are conclusive that it is human blood or it is blood. Some have said, using genetic studies, that they, I think it's University of Texas Health Center, that they've discovered the X and Y chromosomes identifying the person on the shroud is a male. I have problems with that test. But and the other thing is that the blood type was AB, but broken down cell walls can give off false AB tests.
Okay, let's talk more about that when we come back. Can you clone a human from blood? I don't know if you can or not. And this would be very, very old blood. We'll be back with Dr. John DeSalvo in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And back we are with Dr. John DeSalvo. John, let's talk about the blood again just for a moment here. It's pretty old. It could be 2,000 years old. Can it be used to clone another human being, or has it just really collapsed?
Well, again, you know, theoretically, if you had intact DNA, which you would, you know, and you'd need white blood cells in the blood because they have a nucleus which the DNA is located in. Unfortunately, white blood cells disintegrate easily over time, and yes, DNA has been extracted from areas of the shroud, very small samples, degraded. A couple problems. One is, you know, you're really talking about a small sample size, so it's very difficult. And number two, you know, this, how do you know it's actually the DNA is from the shroud and not from a contaminant? You know, the shroud has been kissed and venerated, you know, for hundreds, if not thousands of years, and you have no idea what type of contaminants are on the shroud. So that's a really big problem. You have to make sure that the DNA is coming from, you know, the actual blood that was placed on the shroud initially. So those are the problems we're working with. I don't see we would ever be able to get a full DNA sequence because, as I mentioned, as far as the blood sample is minimal and whatever DNA we can extract is very degraded. So, but again, you know, theoretically, if we found a an intact, you know, set of DNA, we would be able to, you know, karyotype it and determine the DNA sequence.
Why doesn't the Vatican get a pathologist, someone like Cyril Wecht, and say, have at it?
Well, you know, this is something we've experienced with the shroud since I've been involved in research for 30 years. Scientists, we want access to it. We want to do tests. And most of them are non-destructive. You know, it's not like we're going to destroy half of it with a test.
Right,
But, you know, again, the Vatican is very cautious. And I don't blame them. This is the most, in my opinion, important relic in Christianity. And they want to make sure not only that the shroud is safe, but it's not subject to, you know, tests that aren't significant. But I think that they're moving too slow, to be honest with you. I think at this point, the last major tests were done in 1978. We're talking about 30 years. The technology that has advanced, what we could do would be just incredible.
Maybe. Oh, my gosh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's what's so frustrating. And even our team has in the last 30 years, has sent proposals to the Vatican and others and wanted to work with other international teams. And again, we never really got anywhere. I guess we're always hoping something eventually will come through and the shroud will be available for testing. So, it's a big frustration.
It's got to be. And we're going to get into some of your theories next hour, John, and some of the work you've done directly related to the shroud. When was it found? Where? Assuming, again, it's the shroud that Jesus was laid in. When was it found? Where was it kept? The Knight Templars, I've always heard, they were the storage bank for it. What do we know about it?
Well, let's start with 1357 and move forward and then move back from that. Because
okay,
from 1357 to the present, we can, again, pretty much document the precise location. At first, appeared in Lyrie, France, in that year, and the first known public exposition was held. It was probably in Lyrie for about 100 years and then went over to Chambéry, France, around the mid, 1400s. And while in Chambéry, France, it was in a fire in 1532. And when you look at the shroud, you see these scorch marks and parallel lines, scar areas that were caused by a fire of 1532. And then in 1578, it was brought across the Alps to Turin, Italy, where it remains to the present. So that's why I usually say 1357 to the present, we know exactly where it was. Now, prior to 1357, it's speculative. And some of the best history of the shroud has been proposed by Ian Wolfson, who, and a lot of it is speculative and some of it is more substance. One is that it left Jerusalem and went to Odessa, Turkey, and it was considered the image of Odessa. You fold the shroud in four, you see the face in the center, and he thinks that the historical photo, a picture of Jesus known as the image of Odessa, was just a shroud folded in four and then put in a frame. Very interesting. And then from Odessa, Turkey, it went to Constantinople. And when the Fourth Crusade sacked Constantinople in 1204, the shroud disappeared until it appeared in Illyria in 1357. And that's the interval of time people speculate that the Knights Templars had possession of the shroud, from 1204 to 1357. Because we read in some of their writings, they worshipped the head, and they were supposed to kiss a sheet of I'm not sure if it said of Jesus, but there's certain cryptic things in their writings that may point that they did own the shroud or have possession of it. But again, that's very speculative. One of the best pieces of information, which has come out in recent years, dates the shroud or places it as far back as the 12th century. And this is something that was discovered, and it's in the Budapest National Library. And there's a book called The Hungarian Pray Manuscript, P-R-A-Y, not as you pray, but the discoverer of it was named Georgius Pray. So that's why it's called the Pray Manuscript. And what's unfortunately, I don't have a picture of this on my website, but what's fascinating about it is it definitely was created in a Benedictine monastery around 1192, around 1190 to 1195. So we can definitely date it. And they have a picture of Jesus being laid in the tomb, and the body looks just like the shroud. It has four fingers are visible, but more important, below there's a picture of the shroud with the, like, the herringbone wheel, very, very, you know, identifying the shroud. And they're also like L-shaped holes. There's four holes on the shroud that we think were produced somewhere, you know, had to be produced prior to 1532. And these appear exactly on the Hungarian Pray manuscript, a very, very important marker of the shroud. So whoever painted the Hungarian Pray manuscript, whoever drew that, had to have the shroud, or at least a copy of the shroud, because those holes don't mean anything. We think they may have been produced by a puncture. The shroud was folded, and a hot poker may have been placed through it to produce those. But whoever drew the Hungarian Pray manuscript copied those holes exactly. So, and in the weave of the shroud. So, I mean, no question, the person who drew that in the 12th century had seen the shroud. So that's why I'm saying that's one of the strongest pieces of historical evidence that the shroud existed way prior to 1357.
Okay, now, but let's make some assumptions for a moment that it was taken out of the tomb, right?
Okay.
The body was gone. There's this shroud just there. Where does it go then?
Well, the legend has it that the king of Odessa, Abgar V, was ill, or he wanted to see Jesus. He heard about him. And since Jesus was gone, Thaddeus, one of his disciples, brought this shroud to him, and that's how it wound up in Odessa, Turkey. Again, this is legend, and, you know, again, a speculation. So that's the story on why the shroud left Jerusalem and then went to Odessa. And then when Odessa was destroyed, I think around the 8th or 9th century, then it went to Constantinople. And so that's kind of the speculative history. And, you know, there's places in between it may have gone. And so that's, if a lot of that is proven later, we'd have an exact history of the shroud, which unfortunately we don't.
No, we don't. We don't have that at all, and I wish we would. I really wish we would. Okay, now let's get back to your meeting with Father Peter Rinaldi. And he asked you to organize a research group. You know, when? Back in the 80s?
Yeah, about 1983. Well, actually, 1983, he asked me to form a new research team. And basically, the original team, Stirrup, which, I was in a sense a consultant to them. I was working with John Jackson, looking at the image formation theories. And they were, again, a wonderful scientific team, but they were mainly composed of scientists and researchers. And there were about 40 members, mostly from the United States. So Again, excellent team, wonderful research that they did in 1978, and again, groundbreaking studies. And I knew many of the members personally, high respect for all of them. The, one of the things Father Rinaldi wanted to do is establish more of an international multidisciplinary team. So not only scientists, but textile experts, artists, historians, all kinds of different specialists, and from all over the world, not just from Italy. So kind of an international team. So I got together with Fred Zugabe, Dr. Fred Zugabe, who is the famous chief medical examiner of Rockland County, New York, who's currently retired. He's president of the team. And Paul Maloney, a biblical archaeologist from Pennsylvania. I've, again, known Paul for over 30 years, one of the best archaeologists I've ever known. I feel the most knowledgeable person on the Shroud. And we formed Assist, and we wanted to come up with a name that was significant. And I like the acronym Assist because we formed to really help scientists and scholars and others study the Shroud. We weren't going to be just exclusive to one type of discipline or one country, but opened up. But the thing that kept Assist different from like the Holy Shroud Guild and other organizations is we were specialists. Like you had to be a specialist in either like chemistry, physics, history, art, textile. So it wasn't like a group of people interested or a devotional group. It was really scientists and scholars. So and that's really what the name says we are: Association of Scientists and Scholars International for the Shroud of Turin. And we grew to around, I think we're currently around 300 members. We always kind of were around that range from all over the world. So we, as far I know, many of the research teams have disbanded and others have started. So I think I'm pretty accurate in saying we're the oldest and the largest specialist type of Shroud research team, not a devotional team that, you know, anybody can join. So and I'm, you know, really hoping that someday we can get access to the Shroud in conjunction with other teams. I don't think anything should be exclusive with the Shroud. It's the world's relic. It's for everybody. And all teams, all research people should work together. And a lot of tests need to be done over, like the carbon-14. And like I mentioned, we have new science. You know, maybe this is a good place to mention about the carbon-14. You know, it, 1988.
And there was some kind of pollen problem, right?
I'm sorry? Some kind of
pollen?
There
was some kind of problem with pollen that got on the Shroud, and they tried to date it or something?
Well, they couldn't date the pollen, but as far as I could tell, they showed that there were pollen on the Shroud that was just indigenous of Jerusalem or within a 50 to 100-mile area. And as far as you know, the Shroud never was in Jerusalem. I mean, since 1357, it wasn't. So it had to have been there prior to then. Again, evidence that the Shroud, you know, was authentic. But when in 1988, you know, the Vatican allowed three major carbon-14 labs to date the Shroud. And that was Oxford University in England, the Federal Institute of Technology in Zurich, Switzerland, and the British and a University of Arizona. I actually was down there and spoke at that university many years ago. And so those three carbon-14 labs tested the Shroud and came up with a medieval date of around the 13th, 14th century. And so a lot of people said, oh, okay, proves the Shroud was made around the time it appeared in Leary, France, and a lot of people lost interest. Now, you know, as a scientist, I think any good scientist would say when you're doing research and you have 100 data points and 99 fall on a line and one falls off, you don't drop the 99 data points. You look at that anomaly and you say, could this be wrong? I mean, it's possible it's right and the 99 are wrong, but most likely there's something wrong with that data point. So when we looked at it closely, we you know, the sample was taken from the side of the Shroud. And on the side of the Shroud, if you look at one of the pictures I have up on my site, it looks like a 3-inch strip running lengthwise down the side that was like sewn on, like a 3-inch strip was added to the Shroud. You can see the seam quite clearly on the picture. And there's been a lot of speculation. Was that originally part of the main body of the Shroud that was removed and then sewn on? Is it a piece from a different cloth that was sewn on, maybe to balance the image in the center, so when you held it up, you know, it would look centered. I don't know if you know this, George, but that 3-inch side strip is hollow. You could put a pole through it.
That's interesting.
So actually, if it was part of the main body of the shroud, it would have had to been folded over and then sewn. So we don't know. There's so many questions, but we know if it was sewn, the threads would have contaminated that area where the carbon 14 was taken, the sample. Also, if it's not part of the main body of the shroud, maybe it was added in the 13th century. Ray Rogers, famous Los Alamos chemist, did chemical tests to show that part of that area was colored to match the shroud. So there's some chemical evidence that there's contaminants of linen and fibers. So the bottom line is the sample, I felt, was not a good sample. We need to do a better carbon 14 from a sample of the shroud that's more interior. And again, you can use minuscule amounts of carbon 14 of linen now compared to the old type of carbon 14 testing. So it's a test that can be done very simply and very accurate, and it could solve the problem. And there are other problems with carbon 14. I mean, I can go through a list of them why the test could be off.
Yeah, but, sure. Go ahead.
But the bottom line, like in any good science, you repeat the experiment and you look at the anomaly and say, was that off or is it correct? So I think it's something that, needs to be repeated.
You know, with all of this, and we'll get into your personal theory in just a moment when we get to the top of the hour. Tell me about your 3D studies, though, on the shroud image. This is fascinating.
Well, yeah, as I mentioned, in the last 100 years, we've developed the technology, photography in the pictures in 1898. And then in around 1970s, they found out that if you put a picture of the shroud in a type of piece of equipment known as a VP8 image analyzer. In fact, I used that for my research, for my image formation studies. It was a piece of equipment that NASA would use for reconstructing cellular photographs. It showed that the shroud image contained three-dimensional information. Now, what that means, there's nothing magical about it. Why that occurred was that the intensity of the body image, that is, how dark the body image appeared, was directly related to how far the body was from the cloth. For example, the nose would be right up against the cloth, very close to it, so it would be darker. The distance would be smaller, so it would be more intense. Now, the cheeks being further away would be less intense. So there is a relationship between the cloth, the body distance, and the intensity of the image. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So the VP8 image analyzer could measure the intensity, the density of the image, and then plot how the person would be in three dimensions, assuming a drape of the cloth. So that basically was evidence that the cloth did wrap a three-dimensional object, and we could reconstruct that three-dimensional features. And again, I have a couple photos of the VP8 image analyzer on my site. And I do want to thank Barry Schwartz, who was the photographer in 1978, who's been a very good friend of mine for over 30 years and supplied me with these wonderful photos for my website, and always been one of the most gracious and generous shroud researchers that I've ever known. So I had to give a plug for Barry, because he's just been exceptional. He always supplied me with my slides and photos, and one of the true, honest and sincere shroud researchers like Paul Maloney. So I've been very fortunate too, and like with Father Peter Rinaldi, to be involved with very incredible people.
Okay, we're also going to talk about the possibility of levitation involved with this, and also we'll get your theory in just a moment, John DeSalvo, when we come back. John's websites are linked up at coasttocoastam.com. His main one, GizaPyramid.com. We'll give you all the information and some pictures of the Shroud of Turin. I'm George Norrie. We'll be right back.